This is 89.1 WEMU, and I'm David Fair. We've been on a literal hot streak around here, haven't we? Several days in a row, with temperatures at or in excess of 90 degrees. These conditions, particularly on a sustained basis, may impact our health and the health of our environment. The heat wave is the focus of our conversation on this week's Issues of the Environment. My guest is an expert on most all things weather and climate related. Dr. Richard Rood is a professor of climate and space sciences and engineering at the University of Michigan. And thank you for the time today, Dr. Rood.
You're welcome, and thank you for asking me.
Have you been finding ways to stay cool over the last week or so?
Yeah, I always stay cool. I stay indoors.
Well, we've had, as I mentioned, a stretch of hot days now, but we've certainly had these kinds of stretches before. Historically speaking, should we expect these conditions a couple of times each summer as just a normal part of the weather patterns?
Well, I think what you're seeing is that often in the summer you do see the hot spells.
Mm-hmm.
They come up to Michigan, you know, far less frequently than, say, they come up to Kentucky. But one of the things you are seeing in the past and what you're seeing that's going to be happening in the future is that they are going to become more common, and you're going to get these persistent spells of heat. And really, one of the things to think about that's perhaps more important is the humidity that's associated with them.
You went to college in Florida, so you're well accustomed to humidity.
Yeah.
How are we going to see that manifest itself here?
The way you really see it, one is just the more humid air is, you know, more difficult for you to sweat and to cool off in. But in terms of how it impacts sort of the environment and human heat health, one of the most important attributes is that it keeps it much warmer at night. When you have a heat wave and you're thinking of human health effects or the effects of other things in the ecosystem, one of the most important things is how does the environment cool down at night. And with the extra humidity, it holds in more of the heat in the evening. And one of the things you see over the course of a sustained heat wave is that the nighttime lows are what's really going up. And so you start seeing something that's a little almost hard to say. You start to see record high nighttime lows. And so you see that the moisture there keeps it warm, and it just hurts the ability for humans, buildings, and anything else to cool down. So that's one of the biggest manifestations.
And in the outside environment, does that have additional impacts that might not happen with the cooler night temperatures?
Well, of course, it's going to have impacts on, you know, anything ranging from, you know, human comfort to, you know, how some plants pollinate and things like that in terms of temperature sensitivities throughout the environment.
So is this humidity the difference? I mean, you can look to places like Phoenix or Albuquerque where it is hot a good portion of the year as it is here now. Is it that dry heat they're talking about? It lacks that humidity that so affects the environment and then the human health with respiratory issues and such?
You know, since you bring up Albuquerque and Phoenix, it actually complicates things a little bit. With the lack of humidity there, it gets much, much, much warmer in the day. It gets much, much, much cooler at night, sort of a desert environment. So one of the things health-wise in an environment like that is dehydration becomes important. So it's not just a simple problem to say it's hot and wet versus it's hot and dry. The things that grow there, the plants, the animals, are used to the more dry conditions, and the humans, you know, acclimate again in the same way. But if you look at the extraordinary dryness that's occurring out there right now, it's part of the contributor to the big forest fires, which, of course, have huge deleterious effects on humans. So, you know, when you get to a sort of extreme heat, extreme cold, anything that we are not used to and have not adapted to, it tends to have disruptive influences.
And, Dr. Rood, are there any environmental benefits to be had in the kinds of conditions we're seeing now and the kinds of conditions we expect in the future?
So that's an interesting question. One of the benefits that some people would claim is that we get a little bit of a longer growing season. And by getting a longer growing season, you know, we can grow different things. We can grow more. We can grow things that are better. in terms of their yield. And that's the sort of thing that might happen with a small increase in temperature. But as the temperature increases get larger, we actually have to start thinking about new crops to take advantage of something like that. And then, of course, we get to all the complications of the water problems. And the other thing that some people would say about benefits is that less people, you know, are injured by it being cold. But all in all, if you weight all those advantages and disadvantages, then in general, this sort of increase and this sort of, you know, march of increasing heat and higher humidity is generally more disruptive and more negative than it is positive.
You are listening to 89.1 WEMU, and this is Issues of the Environment. We're talking with University of Michigan professor Dr. Richard Rood. Dr. Rood's primary research interests focus on climate change problem solving, and we've kind of touched on this a bit, and with that in mind, Dr. Rood, while solutions are being sought, devised, and hopefully ultimately implemented, we have to adapt. What adaptations do you see as necessary in the short term and then in the longer term as the planet continues to heat up?
So we absolutely have to adapt. We are not going to sort of what we call mitigate or reduce our emissions and avoid the warming and the additional heat. So the adaptations that we have to think of if we just focus on heat like we are now, you know, one of the adaptations, you know, is simply air conditioning. It is cooling centers. It is better material use in cities so that you don't have as large an urban heat island effect. Often it is education of people on how to better cope with the heat. Sometimes it is alerts to emergency rooms and places to be on the lookout for people who are suffering from heat-related illnesses that they're not used to seeing. More broadly, we move to adaptation problems of water and water management in the Midwest because we see this far more periods of extreme precipitation. We're seeing, you know, more urban flooding. We're seeing more flooding in general, like you saw in the Upper Peninsula not so long ago.
Right.
And then, you know, globally, the adaptation really, a lot of it evolves around sea level rise in the next, you know, two or three decades.
Based on your modeling, are we adapting at an efficient enough rate to meet the demands of what the climate is going to put upon us?
I would say no. I think that in some places we remain in denial about what's going to happen. In some instances, we are just beginning to be able to put together the scenarios that allow us to think about this new adaptation. People become concerned about, you know, the cost and whether or not they're spending money efficiently. In general, I think that we are not thinking about this problem very proactively, and we are not doing some of the things that would help to build resilience and make the future smoother than it's going to be.
When we talk about climate change, the term tipping point comes up quite a bit. Are we adapting slowly enough that we will not be able to put off surpassing that tipping point where there's no return?
So I was just wrote a paper not so long ago called Living at the Climate Precipice, where it actually got me to thinking about some of the tipping points. And I would say that at some level there are some tipping points that we are already past. And we are committed to quite a bit of sea level rise. You know, if we look at the next 50, 100, 200 years.
Coastlines are going to change.
Coastlines are going to change, and we're not going to stop that. And so at some level, we have passed a tipping point that leads us to what scientists would call non-stationary, or we will have these sort of systematic trends in sea level rise. One of the tipping points that we need to really start to worry about is what we're changing up in the Arctic, because the Arctic is warming faster than the rest of the planet for a bunch of good physical reasons. The consequences of that is the release of a lot more carbon dioxide and methane that's been stored in the permafrost, and it's also stored in the oceans. And, of course, we're changing the sea ice and the entire energy balance in the Arctic. And one has to become concerned about the release of those greenhouse gases that are in the land, which are actually quite a bit more than have already been released by fossil fuel burning. So that's an important tipping point. And, you know, I think we are need to be extremely careful about doing mitigation or ultimately perhaps removal of carbon dioxide from the atmosphere in order to keep us from reaching those tipping points.
Well, part of the way that we're going to have to adapt is the manner in which we approach these systemic necessary actions in order to deal with climate change effectively. Do you see any indication based on global policy and the policy in the United States we can get to a place of survivability?
Oh, absolutely. In terms of survivability, I think humans are very adaptive. To me, climate does not impact our survivability as much as our response to crises and how we deal with not only climate, but many other aspects of the society has to deal with. If I were to look globally, you can look at a country like the Netherlands and how they are thinking about living with sea level rise over the next 100 to 200 years. And you can see the sort of thinking and the sort of systemic way that they're approaching that and the way their society and their country responds to it. And you look at something like that, and you can feel somewhat hopeful in terms of those adaptation strategies. And likewise, you can look at some individual cities and states in the United States. But if you start to look, say, at the United States as a whole right now, we still struggle with getting our heads around this problem. Going back to what you said at the beginning of this question, I think one of the most important things that we have to learn is how to internalize how we think about the climate and how we deal with the wastes of our energy and internalize this idea that the weather and the climate over the lifetimes of ourselves, our children, our grandchildren, and beyond is not going to be stable. It's not going to be like you can look back to what your father knew as weather and climate and plan in the same ways. And I think that this is a very profound internalization of our behavior. And I think that there's a certain amount of psychological barriers and psychological loss that's going to be associated with that.
And yet, if I'm reading it correctly, I do sense optimism on your part.
Well, I think we, you know, as a species, we can ultimately deal with this problem, but I think it is going to be very disruptive, and the more that we let it grow unbounded, the more disruptive it's going to be.
And Dr. Rood, to bring us back to the impetus for our conversation today, more immediately, what do you expect in Southeast Michigan the rest of this summer? What are we going to see?
I do not really know what the long-term or the medium-term sort of summer forecast is right now. What we do know about the summer and what's coming along right now is we're experiencing another year that's going to be very warm compared to long-term averages, so we should tend to expect it to be warm. The idea of exactly what we can say about whether we're going to continue to see a lot of the extreme precipitation that we've seen in the country, I'm expecting it to be quite hot and wet myself. That's how I would be planning my garden.
Well, Dr. Rood, I thank you so much for your time and your expertise today, and I wish you a happy 4th of July.
Okay, thank you, and happy 4th to you as well.
That is Dr. Richard Rood, Professor of Climate and Space Sciences and Engineering at the University of Michigan. I'm David Fair, and I thank you for listening to this 4th of July edition of Issues of the Environment. It's produced in partnership with the Office of the Washtenaw County Water Resources Commissioner, and it's heard each Wednesday only on 89.1 WEMU-FM and WEMU-HD1 Ypsilanti. May you have a safe and happy holiday, and stay cool.